Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, the bluesologist speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, in the not-so-great white north. And we came out of the box tonight like we did, came out of the box today. It's only 2 o'clock Eastern Time, and I'm talking about tonight, but we came out of the box today with Steel Pulse's Save Black Music. And this is a 35th anniversary of Black Music Month. And I would like to thank a couple of people. I would like to thank Chairman O'Malley Ishitella, who gave me the space on Uhuru Radio to do Diasporic Music. And I would also like to thank Archie Shepp, the man who gave me the concept of Diasporic Music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And Archie Shepp and Chairman O'Malley both hail from Florida, for whatever that is worth. And we have some great, great shows on Uhuru Radio. You can listen to O'Malley Ishitella Speaks. You can listen to Africa Live with Didon Sankara. You can listen to Reparations in Action with Penny Hess. You can listen to Golden Sunday Sounds with Ron Bob Simple, African International with Maitho. We also have Black Agenda Report with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, and Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Simple. On today's show, we happen to have Glenn Ford. He's going to be interviewed at 3:30 today, and at 2:30, we're going to play an interview that we did with Gloria Rolando. And Gloria Rolando is a great Cuban filmmaker, and she did a film called 1912, Breaking the Silence. And we're going to, myself and Melinda Francis interviewed her in Toronto. And we're going to continue in our blues fashion. We are going to listen to Coco Taylor and KRS-One, Boogie Down Productions, and we're going to be listening to Wang Dang Doodle and Breath Control 2.
Toting Nanny, tell fast talking Fanny, dope style by the massive BDP crew. Of course, I will now present to you a different view. The 1990s. Of course, 89 is behind me. So check it out. It's called breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the love. Breath control, the love. Breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the love. KRS-One, yes, the teacher. I wear Clocks and Holy Night sneaker. In your speaker is the new style. I dedicated to the intelligent child. In the front row or behind me, we're gonna pull somebody far for the 90s. You want lyrics? We come correct. BTP, only moving with respect. The other MCs, they can't believe me. Or when I rhyme, it sounds just like a CD. We don't lip sync, we go all live. On stage, I bring about four or five. That's DDI, Sydney, and Melody. I'm myself, Harmony, and Willie D. We come humble, we just rumble. While other MCs crew just crumble. They want dances, they want lighting. They want effects to make them look exciting. But it's frightening, cause without that, the whole crew is wick, 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 whack. BDP comes with the cheapest and perform miracles like Jesus. The total respect, we achieve it. And the big headliner can't believe it. It's called breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the low. Breath control, the low. Breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the low. Get ready for the break. Miss out. We got pages of the dope stuff. So in the record store, you can't pass by us. Get the album, hear the music, and hold on so you just don't lose it. As a reference for any MC that wanna test KRS-One, cause I've been watching these other rap groups. They walk around like they're some kind of big soup. You can't touch them, you only see them in an arena or a big coliseum. So when you watch them for a second, them sound nothing like they do on record. They sound cheesy, them sound wheezy. For $20, boy, you know them never please me. So I see this and prevent this. It's like going for a checkup at the dentist. Cause when you come to a BDP performance, the microphone had better have endurance. Cause we'll check it and then wreck it. And then the sound man has got to accept it. Because it's breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the low. Breath control, the low. Breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the low. Take it out.
Nanga Death is Wolof, and the folks speak Wolof in Senegal, the Gambia, and Mauritania, and Nanga Death is a greeting in the great language of Wolof. And we were listening to the music of KRS-One, Boogie Down Productions. They did a piece called Breath Control 2, and we heard Wang Dang Doodle by the great Coco Taylor, and that was from the pen of the great Willie Dixon, a great, great, great blues man who made all of his money, and his music was recorded by all the big bands in England, and he got all of his rights. So Willie Dixon, his estate is in very, very, very good shape, and someone needs to do a book, maybe myself, on Mr. Willie Dixon, because he is definitely a hero of black music. He refused to fight in the Korean War, and for whatever it's worth, Minister Louis Farrakhan delivered his eulogy at his funeral. June is Black Music Month, and President Barack Hussein Obama has basically dropped Black Music Month. He's changed it to African American Music Appreciation Month, and he's basically taken the only people that he deal with are the Africans in the United States. We have a petition, and if you wanted to sign a petition, you can go to my blog. It's Norman Otis Richmond, wordpress.com, and please sign the petition. Last week, we made a whole lot of mistakes. We were talking a whole lot of stuff, and we were talking about, we mentioned Jimmy Carter. Well, Jimmy Carter established Black Music Month in 1979, but we got mixed up at Clinton's inauguration. When he was inaugurated as President of the United States, he had a whole host of African people at his inauguration. He had Maya Angelou, he had Al Green, he had George Clinton, and he had Steel Pulse. He invited Steel Pulse. And he basically co-opted. I mean, you know, he's a saxophone playing president, so he got a lot of credit for that because he brought all of those African people together. But that's neither here nor there, because as we know, the people that listen to diaspora music and Uhuru Radio know that William Jefferson Clinton is not a friend to Africa. He's not a friend to Haiti. He's not a friend to Black people. He's not a friend to oppressed people, period. But we're going to continue. And there's a young man by the name of G.C. Cameron who was born in Mississippi, but he spent a lot of time in Detroit. And he was the lead singer of the Spinners, and he was the lead singer of the Temptations. And once upon a time, he was a member of the royal family, the royal family being the Gordy family. He was married to one of Barry Gordy's sisters. And we're going to pay tribute to G.C. Cameron. We're going to play three songs by G.C. Cameron and kick back and listen to G.C. Cameron.
Never thought it could be this way. I never thought you'd not be here today. No, all that we've done is right before my eyes. Can you understand why this little man cries? Silly memories of you are all that I can cling to, but how can I be true when all that's left of you are
shadows, nothing but shadows. I can see shadows
everywhere I turn, everything I do. No, they now that you're gone, I've got a little hill to climb, yeah. Cause my life without you is like a song without a rhyme, and you taught me to live. It's not easy, but in you I try. everywhere I turn. You're just one step ahead, girl. I wish that I could control these little old tears.
How do I say goodbye to what we had? The good times that made us laugh outweigh the bad. I thought we'd get so hard to say goodbye to yesterday. I don't know where this road is gonna lead. So hard to say goodbye to yesterday. And I'll take with me the memories to be my sunshine. So hard.
yesterday.
You're listening to Various Folk Music on Uhura Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. We're playing a little music from G.C. Cameron. We heard the first track we heard was called Shadows, and that was dedicated to Marvin Gaye and G.C. Cameron's wife, who passed away. And Shadows was written especially for those two people. It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday was the theme song from the great film Coolie High. And when G.C. Cameron left the Spinners, he did that soundtrack or did that song for the film Coolie High. And I Want to Be By Your Side, that was G.C. Cameron along with Sarita Wright Mohammed, the former wife of Stevie Wonder, and Sarita Wright Mohammed and Stevie Wonder, and another brother by the name of Garrett. His last name was Garrett, but they wrote It's a Shame for G.C. Cameron. We're getting ready to play an interview that we did with Gloria Rolando. Gloria Rolando, a great filmmaker from Cuba. She was in Toronto, and she showed this film called, her latest film called 1912, Breaking the Silence. And we're going to present an interview that myself and Melinda Francis did in Toronto, Canada. This is an interview with Gloria Rolando of Cuba.
And this is Radio Regent. My name is Mally, a.k.a. DocuVixen. We're here on location at the different book list. And here with me is, of course,
Norman Otis Richmond.
And we are here with a filmmaker. Her name is Gloria Rolando, and she had a film screening here yesterday. So maybe, Norman, you were there, so maybe talk a little bit about that.
The film was called 1912, Breaking the Silence, and it is a film about a massacre that took place. It was an independent black political party in Cuba, and it was a massacre in 1912 in Cuba. And this party in Cuba was a black independent party, and it was the first black independent party in the Western Hemisphere, I guess, second after Haitians had parties. And the film was very, very powerful, and I really enjoyed the music. I love the way Gloria Rolando mixes the film with music, and I think the way she does her music in film is like Spike Lee in terms of, yeah, I think Spike Lee is very beautiful when the way he does mixes film and music. So the first question is, how has the film been received in Cuba and outside of Cuba?
Bueno, I had the opportunity to show the three chapters in Cuba. You know that it was a work that I have been developing for 10 years. The first group of interviews were made in 2003. And it's an independent project. So even I don't know how much money I spent, how much energy I had to use in this project, in the middle of our personal difficulties with my mother sick and everything, but and without budget. So it was something that I collect a little money here, a little money there, and I was able to get advance in the different chapters. I remember that the last time that I went here to Toronto, I had all the material, the majority of the material that I used, but I didn't have the money for the first chapter. So between Miguel and part of the teaching that I made in Queens University, I was able to collect a little money to go back home and do the editing. So it was a lot of energy, a big effort, but I learned a lot. I was doing the film, and I was growing as an artist, as a political activist, as a human being, as a black person, because I knew more about our own history. So I was not doing this for a propaganda, for make money, for pleasure to be a black person that have a history and had the opportunity to talk about our history. So there were many things that happened during the shooting and the collaboration of many people, but I had to take care of the production, to direct and be present during the process of the editing until the last moment, you know. But it was important, because why we keep in silence so many years this history? Because it's still painful. It's something that we cannot understand, we cannot assimilate very well, especially black people, even some whites, that this is something that happened in Cuba. We are in May, and with the historical ephemerides, you know, in the newspaper, every day in Granma, that is the official newspaper, they put some headlines about what happened today. The 20th of May, that it was last week, that was the beginning of the uprising of the Independent Party of Color, again, nothing appeared. Appears some articles when 100 years of the foundation of the party in 2008, appears some articles and evaluation in 2012 in the 100 years of the massacre, but again, it doesn't appear. And in the news, not only in the newspaper, in a program in the Canal Habana, the Habana channel, in the afternoon, a black journalist or black historian was telling, made the comments about the most important dates that happened, you know, that the 20th of May, and nothing. Why? Why we continue with this? It doesn't make any sense. I think that some people in the different levels, I cannot say the government. When you say the government, I never hear Raul talking against the Independent Party of Color. Who knows? Sometimes, especially in the Caribbean and the Latinos country, you have a politics that indicates something, and some racist people that they say, no, this is not important to talk about this. Why? This is a black thing, you know? So there are the kind of races that we have in Cuba is very subtle. And in the case of Independent Party of Color, maybe they think that it's not somebody that even doesn't have any influence inside the government, but maybe they say, well, this is something that we don't need to talk very much about. But it's a chapter of the Cuban history. And in my role, and the role of many of the historians that appear in the film, is to continue struggling in order that the people in Cuba, they know about this with our interpretation, not with the interpretation of people outside Cuba who give to this element. For example, some people, they ask, do you think that it's necessary that the black people have another political party? Well, we are living in the different circumstances that the members of the Independent Party of Color. In that moment, they create the party because of they have the need, you know, to formulate, you know, to see the reality for what reason they were struggling during many years during the process of the independence. We are now, people in Cuba, being black or white, we are living in a different circumstance. So I cannot make a comparison that if we need or we don't need a black political party. It's totally another circumstance, you know. But as an artist, I enjoy, I suffer. I enjoy also the company of the people that work with me, because as a director, you don't work alone. You work with a group of people, especially with my editor. And my editor is a white person. He was learning, but he has to ask to get the aesthetic that I want to present in the film, to create an atmosphere, because the big challenge to make this is that I didn't have the possibility to use fiction images to create a scene that I can put in fiction. I have only have headlines, comments of the historians, the music, some photos, the headlines of the newspaper. So the articulation of all of this, it was magic. It took me a long time sitting at home, just watching and listening the interview and establish a speech that I made before to go to the editing room. Especially because when you have a little money, you cannot go to the editing room without the script for the editing. You need to have very clear the ideas that even the moments of the people are going to talk, this guy is going to say this part, and I will connect the other one with this part of the interview. not to arrive to the editing room and then to think, what are you going to do? So it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to do. Ay, pero yo no quiero eso ahora. Yo no quiero eso ahora. Okay.
How long was the process from when you started the developing the film, the shooting, and then the editing?
I said it was 10 years, and I remember that we made one part of the interviews, archive material that we shoot, but then we went in this occasion, we shoot in Havana and Santiago de Cuba, but later I had to go back to Santiago de Cuba. I did more research in the newspaper in Havana. So, and little by little, during all these 10 years, I have been doing on other works also, but I have to develop the project in different moments, mm-hmm. in different moments. It was not easy. It was not something that it was a plan, you know? Working as independent filmmaker, you know when you start, but you don't know when you are going to finish.
In terms of the youth of Cuba, in when you were making this film, how much do the youth of Cuba today know Cuban history in terms of the revolution in the education system? I know in Cuba is probably the second, third, maybe the first most literate part of the Western Hemisphere. But the youth of 2014 Cuba, their education, especially their political education, how are they, because I saw the film and a lot of them didn't know a lot of the things that had taken place, but I guess you're breaking the silence. So could you talk about the youth of today in Cuba?
I don't think that the Jews, they know about this chapter. You know, this is something that in the future, I hope, that the Ministry of Education can take the three chapters and teach the teachers how to teach this chapter of racism in the Cuban history. And not only what happened in 1912, but what happened now. How can we make an evaluation of the racial situation in Cuba? So I think that I made a little contribution that in the future we need to wait because things, they don't move so fast in Cuba, and especially the racial problem, it takes time. So in the books for the Jews, for example, secondary school, or maybe they have a paragraph related with what happened in 1912, but nothing that, you know, that create an expectation that people need to know more or something like that. So it will take time. And as an artist, you know, I move in certain kind of level, in another levels of Ministry of Education, you know, these are other people that they have to move all this thing. It's difficult. But the most important is the writers who wrote about this, and me that made these three chapters. And every time that I have the possibility, I give a copy free to the people. And because in Cuba, we don't have too much money, so... I am open. But, for example, one part of the Jews, the people of the rap, hip-hop movement, they know about this. Because I put the music of that they composed when they knew about the issues of the 1912. They get mad. They get angry. And the voices of the Jews, in one way, they are in the film. When I interviewed the hip-hop guy, in the first chapter, when I interviewed the lady, Yesenia Celier, that had that discussion between the students, and somebody asked, well, what's the problem? What did the black people made it in Cuba? So it's her reflection is moved the film to the beginning. No, we don't need to talk now about the Independent Party of Color. Let's start talking about the history and the contribution and the problematic of the black people before the foundation of the Independent Party of Color. For that reason, I said that the first chapter is like an introduction. In every chapter, I talk about 1912 at the beginning. But especially in the first one, after the introduction, I have to made a return since the slavery time until the process of the independence, the republic, and the foundation of the Independent Party of Colo. It was necessary because people think that it was a crazy group of black people that, they want a party. No, it was very important to talk about what happened. They were the consequence, the logical consequence of the movement of the politics and the way to think of black people since the moment of the independence.
I guess just because I wasn't able to be there yesterday, I guess for listeners, a little bit about the summary of your film. I know it's a long film, but maybe sort of a little bit background of the issues that you touch on in the film.
I didn't get it.
Basically, what do you cover? What does the film cover? Maybe a little bit about background of what your film talks about.
The film covers the struggle of the black people before the foundation of the Independent Party of Colo, the participation in the Liberation Army, the participation in the expectation that they have after the war, and when they saw that they didn't have any rights, that they continue in a very low level of life, they decided to organize a party. The second chapter talked more about the program of the party, the ideas that support the party. They want equal life for everybody in Cuba, being white or black. And, of course, I talk about the women that were members of the Independent Party of Color, how they helped to build the party, especially in the provinces of Cuba, and also all the prejudice that and attack that they suffered because being a black party, they were accused for everything. They were accused to be racist. They were struggling against racism, and they were accused to be racist. So they think that they have influence of what happened in Haiti with the Black Republic of Haiti. And it was terrible because they organized in the second chapter, you could see this, they organized like a movement of the so-called conspiracy that, and they accused the members of the party that they want to abolish the government. So they made inform, they create through the police a lot of reports that it was not true, but we found elements that they made it. They built all this report in order that to put in jail and illegalize the party. That's the way that they caught, that they want to cut the influence and the work of the Independent Party of Colo through the Morúa law, Morúa amendment. And Morúa was a black senator that belonged to the Liberal Party. So it was through a black senator that they want to cut the participation of the Independent Party of Color in the political arena in Cuba. You see? It's sad, but this is something that can tell you the history of black people, how they use our own brothers and sisters to create, you know, problems, serious problems between us. So through the Morúa amendment, the party was declared illegal. Many members of the Independent Party were in jail in 1910. Finally, at the end of the 1910, they released everybody. And between 1910 and 1912, when they get tired of too much political speech and nothing happened, that's when they organized the uprising. So the third chapter cover the 1910 struggle until 1912.
There is parts of the film that talk about the leaders of the party. One of the leaders of the party had a French name, and I know that the histories of Cuba and Haiti are tied. Could you talk about the fact that one of the parties, I can't remember the brother's name.
they use the fact that Pedro Ibonet has a French name to say that this party have the influence or the support, you know, of the Black Republic of Haiti. Okay. That means that that's a way that they supposed to prove that they want to create a Black Republic in Cuba. So that created a lot of fear, the same like in the 19th century in Cuba, when they have a lot of owners of a slave that they want to perpetuate the system of plantation system. So it was very difficult, you know, because these people, the people of the government, they have all the machinaria, all the elements, or the mainstream, the newspaper, the official newspaper. The newspaper that have the members of the Independent Party of Color have a limited circulation. They didn't have the same resources. Not all the blacks were able to read. And so the impact, you know, the influence of the newspaper, official newspaper, was very big. And they create, you know, terrible opinions about the members of the Independent Party of Color. I remember that in some of the cartoon, they present a Evaristo Estenoz and a Pedro Ibonet with the uniforms of like Toussaint Louverture, you know, with the in the French fashion. In order that to confirm that they are, you know, evils, that they are people that
fear
have the
black yeah,
exacto. That's the big theory.
Yeah.
If you have this kind of justification, you can destroy the party, because the party is supposed to be the destruction of the nation.
I guess we've taken up a lot of your time. I have a question about, two questions about the contemporary situation. What is the situation with Africans or black people in Cuba today? And could you talk a little bit about UCL Puig, this baseball player that he's playing with the Los Angeles Dodgers now?
I don't know anything about baseball. I am out of this. No, you don't say.
Okay. But in terms of, but you know, there's a lot of talk about him in the press all over the world, but I guess you don't follow that. Okay. But what is the current situation with under Raul Castro in terms of the situation of black people? Because Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, maintained that the United States government was going to attempt to use the African in America to bring the revolution in Cuba down by promoting the fact that racism exists in Cuba. And could you talk about that?
Yeah, Cuba have, and I don't want to talk about political situation, Cuba have a very economic situation that is very delicate. We are in the middle of the process of changes in the country and everything. Those who have possibility to be more adapted to the changes could be survived much better. The government is trying to maintain the healthcare system free, the education and everything. But it's true that your daily economy is affected by the economic situation, like in the rest of the world, but in the case of Cuba also. Those who doesn't have relatives outside that send money through Miami, etc. And not many black people, they have this possibility, you know. So we need to, you know, to continue there. Some people, they want, maybe they want to leave the country, especially young people. I talk more for my generation. I grew up inside the revolution, and I think that my duty, you know, my art and my energy will be to continue working there. But we are in a very, very special moment that there are, you know, different generations, but only one political process, difference in our economy.
Mm-hmm.
The country is trying to push a lot of our economy, but I am talking about our daily economy that is very difficult. We still have ration, and when you come to places like this, you become crazy because you say, oh, look at how many cereals they have, how many of these, how many of that. So it would take time. It would take time.
All right.
Yep. Thank you so much. Okay. Yeah.
Mira, I nobody gave it. I cannot read so much in English, but music I can listen. Why didn't you give me some music?
Some music.
Yeah.
Or I can.
Nanga Death, I'm speaking a little Wolof again, talking to brothers and sisters and people in Senegal, the Gambia, Mauritania, and the diaspora of the Wolof community. But we just finished listening to Gloria Rinaldo and Rolando, a great film, 1912, Breaking the Silence. Please see it. Make contact with Gloria. Check her out. She's on the internet. Her organization is on the internet. Now we're gonna move on and play some music from a group from Nicaragua. It was there's an African group out of Nicaragua. You know, Nicaragua has a Spanish and there is a English side of Nicaragua, and there's a group that I met that came up here many years ago called Soul Vibrations, and a very great group. They have a song called I Am Black History, I Am Black Culture, and they are from Nicaragua, and Nicaragua is a Spanish-speaking country, and on the coast, some of the people, the African people, speak English. So we're going to listen to Soul Vibrations, and then we're going to come back and start the 3 o'clock portion of Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have Soul Vibes coming to you directly from beholding the happiest barrio in Nicaragua.
3, 4.
Black history, I'm black culture. I'm black history, I'm black culture. We put the labor, the Indians put all the land. They slave every effort out of us, I boost their production. Maybe we have a little share, our people contribution. For 400 years, filling up your nation. I'm black history, I'm black culture. I'm black history, I'm black culture. They kidnap you long ago and disabuse your mind that you don't even know your name, even your language. You were living in a blind state, where you couldn't communicate. They said they're robbing my culture. They said they're robbing my culture.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to the music of Soul Vibrations from Nicaragua. I Am Black History, I Am Black Culture. And we're going to start the second hour of Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio with the music of Buckshot La Funk. Buckshot La Funk was a group that... was a name that Cannonball Adderley used, and Cannonball Adderley was a great saxophonist, alto saxophonist, who made it on his own, but I guess many of us know Cannonball from his work with Miles Davis. But Branford Marcellus, the brother Winton Marcellus, took the name and put a group together called Buckshot LaFunk. And he did a song called I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, and that is Maya Angelou's great poem. So what he did was he took Maya Angelou's poem, mixed it with Fela Kuti from Nigeria, and mixed it with Ruben Blades or Blades from Panama, and came up with a great song, which we're going to feature right now. I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, and this is a non-tribal song. And as Fela is going to say, Ayakaka, Ayaku, Ku. This is Buckshot LaFunk, and I Know Why Cage Bird Sings.
The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. Leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the currents end, and dips his wing in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. His narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped, his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing.
Ayakata,
ayakata,
ayakuku,
ayakata,
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 ayakuku,
ayakata,
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 ayakuku.
Thank you.
sleeps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the currents end and dips his wing in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. That stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped, his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. Fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings a free. For the caged bird sings a free.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to Buckshot LaFunk. That is Branford Marcellus, and he put together Maya Angelou, Fela Kuti, Ayaka Ka, Ayaku Ku, and Ruben Blades out of Panama. And that is a great song. And this is Black Music Month, and Black Music Month is the music of African people on the continent, African people in the Caribbean, African people in Europe, African people in the United States, African people in the Sea Islands, wherever Black people are, in Australia. But one of the hot spots for Black music or African music is Cuba. There's a young man by the name of Benny Moray. He was the Bob Marley of Cuba. He was the Sam Cooke of Cuba. He was the Mighty Sparrow of Cuba. And we're going to listen to some Benny Moray. This was recorded live on Cuban radio. And Benny Moray passed away on November 19th, 1963. And he was born on August 24th, 1919. But this is some great music from Cuba by the great Benny Moray.
Bueno, Benny, vas a complacer ahora a tu pueblo, ¿verdad? Vamos a ofrecer un número alegre.
Sí, pero no es de mi pueblo, no es por allá.
No es de Santa Isabel, ¿no?
No.
Es de aquí del estudio.
No es...
¿De dónde?
No me haga cosita.
Ah, bueno, tienes la cachimba clarita hoy, ¿no?
No, la cachimba está un poco...
Está bien la cachimba hoy.
Regular.
Bueno, entonces...
La cachimba vieja.
Bueno, tú vas a complacer ahí ahora 22 telegramas que tenemos en la oficina. De Cienfuegos.
Ah, me voy.
Entonces va a cantarnos Cienfuegos.
babies. Perla, mi amigo, ahora le diré por qué. Una cienfueguera me dijo, ven y moré. En una tarde de mayo, allá por Pasacaballo, con el rumbo a Rancho Luna, y ella me dio una fortuna en amores. Y en Cienfuegos me quedé, ya tú lo ves. Choca en la orilla mi hermana, de la roca que lo ataca. Me gustó ver cómo encaja el escambray en el llano. Me gustó el techo de guano donde Joaquín nací. Pero lo que más me gustó a mí, si el fuego un pueblo cubano, tú lo ves. Cosita rica, como dice, como yo te llevo a ti.
Se puede por la ciudad, más me gusta a mí.
Pero cosa de mi vida, yo te quiero mucho a ti.
Se puede por la ciudad, más me gusta
a mí. No me digas que yo no te llevo, porque contigo soy feliz.
Se puede por la ciudad, más me gusta a mí.
Thank you.
Nuevo a las 7:20 en Radio Progreso estará Eni Moré y su orquesta gigante.
Yeah.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to the music of Celia Cruz. Now, Celia Cruz performed that. Celia Cruz was with the Fantasia All-Stars, and that was performed in Zaire in 1975. There was a big concert before the Rumble in the Jungle between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman, and that was Mobutu Zaire, Mobutu Sese Seko Wazabanga, and he was a man who made everybody change their name to an African name and made everybody wear African clothes, but did nothing about the economic situation, because personally, I changed my name as a young person. I had took an African name when I was still in my teens, and I used to walk around Los Angeles and Detroit, the United States. You couldn't tell me from Ahmed Sako Touré, but so I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. All I'm saying is that alone is not going to bring us a liberation. I believe what Huey Newton said, that we need a little bit more sterner stuff than changing our names and wearing African clothes. But we're getting ready. We're going to be talking with Glenn Ford momentarily, but we're going to play one more song. We're going to play Night Nurse, a Spanish rendition of Night Nurse by Azur. And this is Black Music Month, and we are looking at African music from the continent, from the Caribbean, and from North America, Europe, South Pacific, wherever African people are, Australia, New Zealand. We believe in Black music, period. We're not like the president, where we only deal with Africans in America and the music that was made there, although it's very great music, and some of the best music on the planet comes from there, but it's not the only music. And let's listen to Night Nurse and come back with Glenn Ford.
Solamente su amor puede hacerme feliz. Dile que el vivir sin ella no es vivir, que sin su amor no podría ser yo feliz. Eres tú la cura de este mi gran dolor. Amor, la cura de este mi gran dolor.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And joining me on the line is Glenn Ford. Glenn Ford has had a long career in radio as a radio host and commentator in 1977. Glenn co-launched, produced, and hosted America's Black Forum, the first nationally syndicated Black News interview program on commercial television. And in 1987, Glenn launched Wrap It Up, the first nationally syndicated hip-hop music show, and it broadcasts, some say, 65, 66 stations. But we know Glenn Ford on Uhuru Radio as the co-founder of Black Agenda Report, and we welcome Glenn Ford to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. How are you doing today, my good friend?
Oh, glad for the opportunity to speak with you, Norman.
Now, Glenn Ford is the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, but we wanted to talk about Black Music Month has been changed to African American Music Appreciation Month by President Barack Hussein Obama. But I know that when you were involved in the music industry, there were some changes that took place that basically have ramifications today when we talk about, you know, when the hip-hop music was, and culture, I guess, was co-opted by corporate power. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and in terms of name changes, everything Black has been through a lot of name changes, including Black Radio, which then became Urban. We might talk about that a little bit later on in the program. During the period from 1987 to 93, when we were operating Wrap It Up, which was the first nationally syndicated hip-hop music program on commercial radio. We watched this tremendous transformation, not just in how hip-hop music is created and then marketed, but in the consolidation of the radio industry, of the music industry, rather, and radio in general. In 87, when we began, basically, there were two poles, uneven poles of hip-hop music production, and that was New York City, which was like Jupiter, the biggest planet in the system, and then some outposts in L.A. and a few other, and Philadelphia and a few other places, but New York was Grand Central Station, and most of the product was coming out of small independent labels, most of them not Black-owned, but small. Next Plateau Records and Fourth and Broadway and Def Jam came into being. This was music that was political. Yes, there was lots of political music, but most of it was party music. After all, I mean, hip-hop came out of mixes that people made for parties. And so young Black people did have some residue of the political consciousness that developed that at least they had a memory of from the 60s. But mainly we're talking about party music, and mostly produced, almost entirely produced, actually, by these small labels. By 90, 91, it was clear that hip-hop was here to stay, that it was a very lucrative market, that it was growing. And so the major labels started looking at the genre and how they could get a hold of it. And they did what corporations always do. We have to understand that even though they throw people like P. Diddy out there as the faces of corporations, there are some very boring guys with glasses and pencils and computers who are making the same kind of decisions as the people who make Heinz soup and other products. And so they did a study of the hip-hop market, and the first thing they wanted to know was how would they define the demographics of the most active cohort? That is, who are the core listeners to and buyers of hip-hop music? They wanted to define that core so that whatever product they created, if they decided to get into hip-hop big time, so that they would be making products for that core market. So they did what corporations always do. They did a demographic study, and they found something that was absolutely extraordinary. The most active cohort of hip-hop listenership and buyers was 11 and 12 and 13-year-olds. And in the business, that's called tweens. They are not yet classified as teens. And this was, a fantastic discovery, because it was the youngest core demographic for any genre that had been discovered ever. At the height of R&B's popularity, and that was in the 60s, that was your generation and mine, Norman, right. The core demographic, the most active demographic, was 15 and 16 years old. And that's why we had so much wonderful, sweet love music, as well as party music, coming out of the huge constellation of small record labels that were producing most of the products. Motown was small. Stax Records was small.
Philadelphia International, yeah.
Was small, and you had scores of these labels, each of which had a whole stable of performers, many of them still household names today. So there was a great deal of product, and much of it, most of it, was directed towards that core demographic of the 60s, the most active listener and buying group, which was 15 and 16 years old. So here, fast forward to 90, 91, when the big corporations are looking at hip-hop and deciding what kind of move they're going to make, and they discover that the core demographic is 11, 12, and 13. Well, it doesn't take a social scientist to understand what conclusions they would draw then. 11, 12, and 13-year-old males especially, but many of these characteristics apply to females as well, are distrustful of, don't know how to act around, and behave with a nervous hostility towards females. So the opposite sex. They're not comfortable around them yet. They're not yet mature enough. Girls are of that age are somewhat more advanced than the boys, but still some of those same characteristics. So at that point, when these big corporations, and they jumped in with all 4 feet in 90, 91, 92, all of them were aware of this study, and I forget which one of the majors made the study, but it was the
Columbia. It was Columbia, Columbia Records. I think Clive Davis, wasn't it? Right.
Okay, and everybody was aware of it because it was so earth-shaking, and so that was what informed them in terms of setting up their little subsidiary rap labels, which were really not independents; they were spinoffs from the majors, or their purchases, and what they would do with the independent labels that they purchased, and they just bought them up like a vacuum cleaner, just sucked them up. And they started directing their products to what they imagined 11, 12, and 13-year-olds would like. And everybody knows that 11 and 12-year-olds, tweens, love to curse. They love to hear the vulgarity flowing from their mouths. It's a new sensation. In fact, you remember, I think you can remember, far enough back when you were like that. So the profanity.
I could definitely remember.
The juvenile and sub-juvenile levels of profanity just permeated the music. The bitchifying of women became the dominant theme. I remember, you know, we used to do our interviews with the artists right there in the apartment on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. That way people wouldn't waste our time by showing up late for meetings for appointments. They'd have to come to us, and we'd be working anyway, so they couldn't waste our time. So all the interviews with the performers were done on our kitchen table. And I can't tell you how many, and not just young men, but female performers were like reduced to tears, complaining, crying about how the A&R people, the artists and recording guys, were forcing them to become, I think the term of art back then was street. I remember one young female performer was saying, "They're trying to turn me into a hoe. They're trying to turn me into a hoe." She was just besides herself.
Right.
Young men felt that they were being coarsened and made into people that they were not as artists, as the industry decided to package them as what they thought 11, 12, and 13-year-olds would like. And the result here has been, because this same mentality, the same marketing strategy prevails at the majors, is that they have caused a kind of arrested development among our young people. That is, the young folks who were 12 and 15 and 20 years old in the early 90s, well, those people are still hip-hop listeners, you know, like 25 years later, and being fed a diet of tween food designed for 12, 11 and 12-year-olds, and they're still consuming it. It's as if a black cultural product has been put in a state of arrested development as the corporations put out product that is designed for the cohort that they identified back in 90 and 91. And so the vulgarity and the anti-female lyrics, they actually flow not from some conspiracy to poison black culture. Corporations don't have a vice president for poisoning black people. It flows actually from the very way that they operate, how they make business decisions, and their ability as they monopolize, as they consolidate, as fewer and fewer of them control more and more of the totality of the marketplace, to enforce the kind of cultural hegemony, cultural product hegemony that they do.
Well, let me say, I'm speaking with Glenn Ford, the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, and we're talking about, black music. But you remember, being from New Jersey, Sylvia Robinson came out, and she did a Love Is Strange, kind of a calypso thing. When she started out doing some calypso, she was with Mickey Stevens, I believe. Then she did Pillow Talk. Then she started Sugar Hill Gang Records, I guess. They're one of the first labels. That's one of the labels that you were talking about, right?
Yeah, and in fact, that comes significantly before we entered that whole arena in 1987. I had not been doing music.
That was 10 years before,
time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And would not have done that. I just wanted to tell you listeners, that was a real deviation for me in terms of my life's work. But people who knew that I had some background, of course, in radio, kept saying that this hip-hop phenomenon is a permanent fixture. It's exciting, and you ought to look into it. I'm talking about people who love music, but they didn't have any experience in commercial radio as I did. My experience was in news and serious stuff. But they convinced me. How often in a lifetime do you get a chance to be part of a whole new genre of your people's music in its developmental stages? It was just too exciting a prospect to pass up. So I did put down some of my serious work, political work, to explore what was happening among our young folks with this hip-hop thing.
Regresar a mí y que sea pronto ya. Porque solamente su amor puede hacerme feliz. Dile que el vivir sin ella no es vivir. Sin su amor no podría ser yo feliz. Amor, eres tú la cura de este mi gran dolor. Amor, esta herida crece más. Pensarlo duele más al saber que te perdí. Porque nadie más que tú sabes dar lo que en la vida nunca sentí. Amor, eres tú la cura de este mi gran dolor. Perdí. ya. Porque solamente su amor puede hacerme feliz. Dile que el vivir sin ella no es vivir. Que sin su amor no podría ser yo feliz. Eres tú la cura de este mi gran dolor. Amor, esta herida crece más. No quisiera más vivir. Y al pensarlo duele más al saber que te perdí. Nadie más que tú sabes dar lo que en la vida nunca sentí. Amor, eres tú la cura de este mi gran dolor.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera. me dijo Martín, yo soy un hombre sincero. ¿De dónde eres de La Palma?
Dilo, Celia.
Y antes de morir, yo quiero cantar mis versos del alma. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
Thank you.